Good afternoon and welcome to today's Compliance Week webcast brought to you by Pillsbury Law. I'm Joe McCafferty, Executive Editor of Compliance Week, and I'll be hosting today's webcast. This afternoon, we're going to be talking about compliance and regulatory risks in China. Today's presentation is part of Compliance Week's World Tour webcast series, where we look at compliance and regulatory risks around the globe. Before we hear from our guests, let me quickly go over the agenda for this afternoon. We're scheduled to go for 1 hour. I'll give a brief introduction and then we'll jump into the presentation, sponsored by Pillsbury Law. The presentation will be followed by a question and answer session. Your questions will be confidential and anonymous, so don't be shy. You can ask your question at any time by using the Ask a Question function on the left-hand side of your screen. And I'll pose them to our guests at the end of the presentation. This webcast will also offer CPE credits. To obtain your CPE credit, wait until the webcast is over and I sign off. At that point, the final exam will be presented automatically in a separate window. If you have trouble viewing the CPE test or receiving the CPE certificate for any reason, please send an email to info@compliancework.com to request a copy. A few other administrative details: at any time during the presentation, you can download the slides from the drop-down menu on the left-hand side of your screen. You can also hit the View Slide Full Screen button at the bottom of your screen if you wish to increase the size of the slides. And lastly, a help button is located in the upper right-hand corner of your screen for assistance. Today's webcast is part of Compliance Week's World Tour webcast series that is examining the compliance and regulatory risks of doing business with various international trading partners. We hold these webcasts just about every week, usually on Thursdays. Our guests have been chief compliance and governance officers at leading public companies and experts on various compliance, regulatory, governance, and risk topics. You can visit www.compliancework.com for an upcoming schedule of future webcasts or to register. Also, I wanted to let everyone know that our annual conference is coming up on May 20th and 22nd. That's in Washington, D.C. For information on that or to register for that, you can go to conference.compliancework.com. I understand those spaces are filling up quickly, so if you intend to do that, please do. So let's begin our program. Today we're very happy to have with us Thomas Shoesmith. He is partner and leader of Pillsbury's China practice. Tom specializes in international corporate transactions with a special emphasis on China, and has handled more than 100 cross-border acquisitions and complex multinational joint ventures involving more than 50 countries around the world. We also have with us William Sullivan, Jr. He's a partner and co-leader of Pillsbury's Corporate Investigations and White Collar Defense Practice. Bill concentrates on corporate internal investigations, trial practice and white collar criminal defense, complex civil litigation, securities enforcement, export control, and other regulatory actions. Bill has prepared, implemented, audited, investigated, and successfully defended compliance and business strategy programs for companies engaged in industries as diverse as manufacturing, defense, telecommunications, finance, energy, pharmaceuticals, and aerospace. We also have with us Henry Liu. He is a partner and leader of Pillsbury's financial institutions and infrastructure teams for Asia and Greater China. Henry spends a significant portion of his time in the firm's other offices, including Shanghai, and works across business sections and geographical regions, focuses on providing integrated and quality services and advice to U.S. and global, as well as Greater China and Asia businesses. We're very happy to have the three of you here. Tom, do you want to get us started?
Sure. Thank you, Joe. My task is to talk about regulation of the Internet in China. It's a big topic, but a big country. I'll also touch a little bit on data privacy, which is increasingly important for companies around the world and is important in sort of an emerging way in China. First off, China is everything in China is huge, and the Internet is no exception. China has as many Internet users, according to a recent McKinsey report, China has as many Internet users as the next four countries combined. The next four countries, if I remember, are the U.S., Germany, maybe Korea, and somebody else. And it amounts to about 500 or 600 million users of the internet in China. Not only that, but Chinese users of internet in China tend to be much more involved in social media than users in North America and Western Europe, and moreover, have a higher propensity, apparently, to buy things which are promoted by word of mouth, so to speak, on social media. So the internet not only has a tremendously high penetration in China among businesses, but among people as well, and is, from a commercial point of view, probably more powerful in China than it is in other places. All of that's very good news. For commercial interests, it's also basically threatening news for Beijing. Beijing, as a general proposition, is leery, suspicious, I'm not sure what the right word is, of any system or situation which permits communication among large numbers of people simultaneously. And that suspicion has extended from things like Mary Kay-type direct marketing, where so the whole point is everybody gets together and has a big rally and shares information, to Falun Gong, which is a quasi-religious kind of a thing where everybody gets together and breathes together. Causes unease in Beijing. So imagine how Beijing feels about a situation where if they're worried about 6 or 8 people getting together, how about 6 or 8 million or 60 million or 600 million people all doing something together? Twitter is blocked in China, so is Facebook, all for reasons that tie to suspicion on the part of Beijing of anything that's going on the internet. This is relevant to compliance officers and companies because it sets a tone for the regulatory environment in China, which is pervasive and a total fact of life in China, and the more so because the Chinese are, as I've said, our Chinese government anyway, is concerned about the destabilizing impact of the internet. So with that sort of happy background, let's pass right over the photograph of me and go to talking about actual regulation of the internet in China. The first question people ask is, given that almost everybody is doing business with, particularly if any part of your business is conducted over the internet, it's almost inevitable that you're going to have customers or users in China, but you may not be in China. So the first question people ask is, do I need to worry at all about the Chinese laws relating to regulation of the internet, permissible and impermissible content, and data privacy? And the answer is, as it always is in China, you can either say the answer is yes and no, or you can say, well, there's a technical answer and then there's a practical answer. The technical answer is that the Chinese laws regulating the internet are pretty careful to disclaim any extraterritorial reach. So on their face, the Chinese laws regulating the internet only apply to companies which have servers in China. So if you are doing whatever you're doing, even if you're targeting the Chinese market, like the New York Times website, for example, the New York Times website in Chinese is all maintained on servers outside of China, clearly targeted at a Chinese readership. So if your servers are outside of China, then technically the law doesn't apply to you. That's the good news. The bad news is that the Chinese government only, whether the law applies to you is only one consideration for whether the Chinese government will have something to say about whether you can continue to reach users using the internet. Websites can be and very frequently are either blocked or redirected to other websites if the Chinese regulators who are constantly monitoring what's passing over the internet don't like what's happening on your website. So why put, with that in mind, you may wind up being blocked anyway, and therefore it's a good idea to know, at least in a general sense, what it is that's going to upset the Chinese regulators, even if you're not technically subject to their laws. Why would you subject yourself to their laws anyway, if you could put your servers offshore, that is outside of China, and conduct business why would anybody put their servers onshore and subject themselves directly to Chinese regulation? And the answer is, as a practical matter, there are three things that drive people to put servers onshore, and these may be applicable to your business and maybe not. One thing is that if your users are using the internet to have any kind of financial transaction with you, having a financial transaction with a Chinese customer or a Chinese user in USD is almost impossible. There are a few people with USD credit cards, but for the most part, you can't. A Chinese user of the internet can't pay for something in US dollars. And the only way to accept Chinese currency is to be in China. So if your business model includes collecting money over the internet from users, you pretty much have to be in China. Now, there are workarounds for all of this. I mean, Facebook is blocked in China but still claims 30 million users in China. It's all done through VPNs and various kinds of other things. But if you really want to attack the Chinese market, forcing your customers to jump through hoops like that is maybe not a good business strategy. The second thing is, if your server is not in China, the connection speed to your server is very low. Now, that may not, because everything has to pass through certain nodes, it may not make a whole lot of difference to you, but if your website involves advertising, which is video-based or any other kind of streaming information, a lag of 3, 4, 5, 6 seconds, it may be enough to lose a customer. So that's another reason people go to China, even though it means subjecting themselves to Chinese regulation. The third thing is that depending on how important China is to your business, you may find a need to have personnel in China and an office in China. And my experience, anyhow, talking to clients, is once companies set up a subsidiary in China and put people there, and their internet presence in China is all in Chinese and needs to be maintained by people who know what's going on in China, it just becomes more trouble than it's worth to keep the server, keep that website maintained outside of China. So those are three reasons why companies who could put their servers outside of China, nevertheless maintain their servers and their web presence inside China and subject themselves to PRC law. So assuming you are subject to PRC law, then the next question is whether you are using the internet for commercial purposes or non-commercial purposes. A subscription-based service is obviously a commercial purpose, whereas let's say providing just information about your company so people can go and find out where your address is and so forth is obviously non-commercial. If you're lucky enough to be in the non-commercial space, then all that's required is a notice filing. It's fairly simple. You don't have to have a special license or permit, and at least from the point of view of permitting, life is pretty easy. You're still subject to all the other restrictions on what you can do over the internet, but in terms of permitting, it's easier. On the other hand, if you're using the internet for any kind of commercial purposes, then you need your business is going to require a Chinese Internet Content Provider or ICP license. The problem with ICP licenses in China is that they used to be completely unavailable to any foreign company, non-Chinese company, or even any Chinese company that had a foreign shareholder in it, which is a difficult proposition. The law changed some time ago to permit 50-50 joint ventures, Sino-foreign joint ventures, to hold ICP licenses directly, but there have only been a dozen or so issued, and there are hundreds and hundreds of foreign companies that want to do business over the internet in China. How do they do it? They all use what's called variously a SINA model for SINA.com, or a variable interest entity model, or a contractual model, the essence of which is that the foreign company signs contracts with a Chinese company which holds the ICP license and is tied to the foreign company by a web of contracts. The contracts are such that the financials of the Chinese company that holds the ICP license are consolidated with the foreign companies, So if the revenue is flowing through the Chinese company, it means that the parent company revenues, you can consolidate those revenues into yours. That's good. The downside of it is, of course, if this is just one part of your business, it may not be that important, but if doing business over the Internet in China is central to your business plan, your investors may be somewhat concerned that you don't actually own the ICP license, and you may get questions from shareholders about what happens if the Chinese nationals who own the separate Chinese company holding the ICP license get unhappy with you and terminate the contracts. All of a sudden, you're dead in the water in China. That's a serious question. The licenses that are required are going to be at both at the national, provincial, and often local levels, and there are going to be many of them. So it's from a compliance officer's point of view, it's a long checklist kind of a proposition. And depending on the industry you're in, there will be industry-specific licenses required. If you're in cultural products, then the Ministry of Culture will want to have something to do with this. If you are streaming bits from movies or television, then the state administration of radio, television, film, and something, I forget the rest of it, will need to give you a permit as well. So let's talk about a compliance checklist. We're getting close to the end of my piece here, so we'll run through this pretty quickly. We have available a sort of a handout that has all this information in it, and we'll be providing that to you, I think, through Compliance Week after the conference. That'll have more information and more detail, and also maybe a few more items that I'll mention here. Assuming you're licensed properly, then the kinds of things that you need to worry about if you're doing business over using the Internet in China start with data retention. Internet service providers have to maintain records for up to 60 days of content on the website, subscriber access counts, account numbers of subscribers, and other information, including in many cases the real names of users, which can put a chill on the users of your website, depending on the kind of website we're talking about. You also are required by Chinese law to create and to establish and maintain network and information security procedures. It's not entirely clear what this means, but it's generally understood to mean procedures to maintain the privacy of data you have, but also procedures to catch and take down any impermissible content, which we'll get to in a minute. That basically means that you as a foreign company, as any internet company in China, have to have people within your organization who monitor and self-censor. The kinds of things that are listed as impermissible in China include things like undermining the PRC's religious policy or propagating heretical teachings, anything that harms the dignity or interests of the states or incites ethnic hatred, and of course anything otherwise prohibited. Many companies have, some companies, particularly file sharing companies and social media companies, have up to a third of their workforce engaged in self-censorship. So the Chinese government is very helpful on a daily basis in sending you emails telling you what it is that you're supposed to censor. We'll do data privacy in 30 seconds here, and then I'll close. Let's go to the next slide. Data privacy is very new in China. It used to be regulated sort of piecemeal around the country, but in 2011 and 2012 there were national level regulations and guidelines that set out a fairly rudimentary compared to Europe data privacy regime, but I think it's a signal that China is going to start taking data privacy seriously. These regulations would apply to any company maintaining information on servers in China where they've collected personal data on people, and the rules require you to adopt and comply with data protection rules internally, so if the government comes calling, you're going to want to have a set of policies to show. You do have to obtain user consent to collect the data and consent for a specific purpose, they have to consent to the purpose for which you're collecting the data, and then you must only use it for that purpose. You have to have safeguards in place to prevent leakage of personal data, and you're not allowed to trade in users' personal information, which obviously is a problem for people who are selling mailing lists or selling lists of emails. That's prohibited in China. And data breaches have to be reported to the authorities, and the companies are under an obligation to comply with the authorities to take action to contain data breaches once they've happened. So that's about it for China and the Internet. The key takeaways on this are, unlike in many other countries, the Internet is viewed explicitly as, I would say, as subversive in China. It's inherently subversive, but that's a problem in China. Regulation is still sort of piecemeal, but it's coalescing quickly. As a foreigner, you're under particular scrutiny, and that means that complying with Internet regulation in China is going to add cost, time, personnel, and burden to your operations. My advice to you is make sure that you understand exactly what's required and comply with it. That doesn't necessarily mean nobody will ask any questions, but when they do, you'll have an answer. So let me turn it over. I've eaten into a little bit of Bill's time here, but let me turn this over to Bill, my partner Bill Sullivan, to talk about FCPA and other types of white-collar compliance issues. Thanks very much for listening.
Thank you, Tom, and good afternoon, everyone. I'm going to talk about the management and the prevention of regulatory and enforcement risk in China. And obviously, we're all well aware of the very high-profile regulatory tool that both the DOJ and the SEC is known to use. As a former federal prosecutor, I have never seen such a tool as the FCPA used as frequently and as broadly in connection with regulating international and transnational business activities. As a matter of fact, I think we're all very familiar with the FCPA being the basis for dozens of enforcement actions, billions of dollars in criminal and civil fines, jail terms meted out, the vigorous pursuit of individual executives. But trials have been few, and unlike other prominent criminal statutes, the Sherman Act, the Clean Air Act in particular, there's hardly any case law, no formal agency regulations interpreting the act. And for many years, many corporate citizens have felt unsure as to how to conform their conduct to the law and unclear as to how the government's perspectives on consistent application and enforcement can be read. And this is going to be particularly true of emerging markets, particularly China. And so during the course of time, when there was a lack of clarity, there were many calls, many loud calls to DOJ to set forth its perspectives on how businesses are to conduct themselves in compliance with law. Some guideposts, some guidelines finally came to pass in November of 2012 when the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act Resource Guide was finally published. It's a large volume. It's over 100 pages. And the DOJ is very careful, in concert with the SEC, who's a joint author, to say that this is non-binding and it's informal. It summarizes various statutes and prior pronouncements and offers no new substantive statutory interpretations, procedural reforms, or formal policy statements. But what we think it does do is offer insights into how the government does assess corporate behavior and compliance, how the government makes enforcement decisions, and importantly, what mitigation factors can influence the enforcement decision practice, something that all compliance officers should know and be aware of. We believe that the guidance strongly suggests that DOJ and the SEC are embracing compliance efforts as a mitigating factor against corporate liability. In fact, the greatest criticism of the way the FCPA has been enforced has been a lack of transparency into what the government uses to make its enforcement decisions and how the government views compliance or attempts at compliance by various corporations and transnational businesses. We have often counseled our clients to look at compliance as an insurance policy. In your everyday life, you seek to manage or mitigate risk. You have insurance for your home, for your auto. You have insurance for your life. You have insurance for your health. These are all ways to manage and to prevent harm or to handle harm when it comes, and sometimes it comes without any warning or any act that would be seen as a normal precursor. So compliance programs are a way to manage that type of risk, to forestall DOJ from pursuing the corporate entity in addition to potential individual persons who may not have followed the compliance programs in-house and thereby may have acted beyond the scope. If a company has a compliance program, it's going to be able to hold itself above. It will find a safe harbor. Now, the UK Bribery Act has a compliance defense. We're not going so far as to suggest that there is a compliance defense written into the guidance, but we do believe that the DOJ will look at compliance, a robust, effective compliance program, as a serious mitigator when it comes to evaluating an enforcement decision. And the government itself, in its compliance guidance, talked about the Morgan Stanley case. And for the very first time, it did publicly link its decision not to pursue FCPA-related charges to a company's compliance program, which detected wrongdoing at a very early stage, leading to a voluntary disclosure. Even though many practitioners believe the government's moving toward a long-sought compliance defense, that's not necessarily the case, nor is it particularly relevant. What is relevant is that in repeatedly citing the Morgan Stanley case, there is good reason to believe that a robust and effective compliance program will lead to a very muted response by DOJ in connection with corporate liability for bribery-related violations, violations relating to obtaining business in violation of the provisions of the FCPA. We have a quote here on this slide that talks about the appropriate circumstances whereby DOJ and the SEC may decline to pursue charges based on an effective compliance program, or may even seek to reward a company for its program. What happened in Morgan Stanley? Why was it that this case was such that the DOJ was able to use it and to elevate it to the suggestion that this is how a compliance program should work, this is why we're not going to target the company? An employee there, an American citizen working for Morgan Stanley in Singapore, convinced Morgan Stanley to sell an interest in a Shanghai real estate property to a state-owned firm. Nevertheless, this firm was actually a shell company set up by Peterson and his co-conspirators in the Chinese government. They all garnered millions of dollars in profit. How good was the Morgan Stanley compliance program? In investigating the case, DOJ found that Morgan Stanley maintained significant internal controls designed to prevent precisely that type of corruption, including monitoring transactions, conducting random audits, and exercising due diligence with new business partners. The policies were updated regularly, and employees were trained in FCPA compliance. In fact, records showed that Morgan Stanley trained the individual responsible, Peterson, on the FCPA 7 times during the time frame of the fraud and reminded him of the FCPA rules 35 times. You might be thinking, that certainly is a platinum compliance program. I guess it didn't work. Well, you're right, it didn't work in the case of Garth Peterson, but that's not the point. No compliance program can be perfect. Individuals always have the opportunity to be trained, to understand what the FCPA provides, to understand what an internal compliance program requires, yet they always have the ability, they have free will, they have the ability to exercise a wrong choice without the sanction or the authority or the sponsorship of the company. And that's precisely the point of a compliance program. You're not going to be held responsible as a corporate entity for the misdeeds of an individual who goes rogue, who had the training, who was apprised of the rules and requirements, and still makes the wrong choice. That compliance program is an insurance policy to protect the corporate entity. As I mentioned before, we've counseled our clients about how effective FCPA compliance should work and can work. It is not a boilerplate approach. It is not one size fits all. It is more akin to a performance standard. The government will look to the program and evaluate how it's designed and tailored to particular risks, whether it's applied in good faith, and how effective it might be. So the FCPA risk-based approach to compliance encourages multinational companies to devote their compliance resources to the areas where problems are most likely to be found and likely to be significant. Now, we don't suggest that aspects of compliance in terms of making sure that the FCPA provisions are upheld minimize particular areas, but there are some areas that are more important than others in connection with how your company does business. Devoting a disproportionate amount of time to modest entertainment is not a value add if you're engaged in major government bids and there's no awareness of how those government entities are being solicited, if they are being solicited, whether or not questionable payments to third parties exist, whether business intermediaries are used. That should be the key focus. A comprehensive compliance program requires the effort of employees throughout the organization, management and sales, marketing, accounting, finance, and an integrated program has got to have as a precursor, as a fundamental base platform, a tailored risk assessment. This is what I meant a few minutes ago when I was advising that we focus on where the risk may lie, not to eliminate or to avoid all aspects of an FCPA compliance program, but modest entertainment may not be the true focus of a company that does business in high-risk areas, may have to use intermediaries. So the company needs to identify specific risks in light of its industry, geography, and business structure. If a company does substantial business in China, for example, there may be heightened risks relating to entertainment and meals. If a company participates in joint ventures, where those joint ventures are going to be pursued in concert with government entities, how those joint ventures come to pass and the understanding of the relationship with those government entities and what degree of control the U.S. entity will have to be a primary focus and a primary feature. I want to make a few quick points also that are highlighted in the guidance relating to due diligence and post-acquisition liability. The guidance makes it very, very clear that the DOJ and SEC are serious about the need for companies to conduct due diligence revolving and pivoting around acquisitions. Both pre- and post-acquisition due diligence is required because of successor liability. There are two stages of the M&A process that are highlighted in the guidance. First, the guidance underscores the need for effective FCPA due diligence and understanding the target's business and value before closing. That makes good business sense not only from the FCPA compliance perspective, but also from the business judgment perspective. And what do I mean by that? Not only are you avoiding risk of enforcement relating to an entity that may have obtained much of its revenue stream by improper payments or improper third-party business intermediaries, contact with government officials. But aside from the FCPA risk, you're also investing in a company whose own success is tainted and therefore could not be considered to be potentially long-standing, would not have a good shelf life in connection with how it's been making its money. It's not so good to invest in companies that have tainted income streams like that. It just doesn't make business sense. So from a business perspective as well as from an enforcement perspective, you want to understand the income stream. It just makes sense in general. And second, you need to understand that once you've gone forward and acquired the target, if you don't bring that target under the umbrella of your own compliance program, you're also going to subject yourself to successor liability. Businesses need to know that their newly acquired subsidiaries, as well as joint ventures and related entities, have to be brought under the anti-corruption compliance program quickly and completely to make sure that the entity itself, the acquirer, avoids FCPA successor liability. A few quick notes on doing business in China with a view toward the DOJ enforcement perspective as outlined by the guidance. China is one of the highest of risk jurisdictions in the eyes of DOJ. It receives a tremendous amount of attention. Some of my work over the past 2 years has been focused almost exclusively in Chinese joint ventures and transactions. A lot of my internal investigations have been focused in China. DOJ has its eyes on China. We expect this trend to accelerate because more and more Western businesses are expanding. It is a huge emerging market. There is great opportunity there, and as Tom said, there's a way to do it. You just have to do it correctly and with your eyes open. There are challenges in determining state ownership. I mentioned this before in connection with the JV venture or who your customer might be for purposes of pursuing customers. Corporate structures are often very difficult to understand, opaque as we say in the PowerPoint, and it really can be hard to know whether or not a company is state owned or not. There is a very expansive gift and entertainment culture. The culture norm of Guanxi, gifts and favors are common and are very routine. And lavish entertainment and expensive trips are also seen. And these are red flags. Again, you need to prioritize these in connection with your overall compliance and to understand that it is important to be able to handle modest entertainment and handle trips under the umbrella of a legitimate business exercise. Don't be paralyzed for purposes of pursuing business in China because you don't find that business and entertainment and the rules relating thereto are easy to understand. Do things with a degree of modesty. Make sure there's always a business component to any such venture, and you'll be protected to the best you possibly can. Remember, compliance programs are not designed to have to be perfect. They are designed to make sure that you understand what's required, you're using best efforts, best judgments, and good faith for purposes of what's required. You're eliminating red flags while you're pursuing your business. You're allowed to make a profit. Rapid corporate growth and lack of compliance structures is seen frequently in China because it has got an economic turbocharged system that has had quick development and growth, and sometimes the compliance architecture has not caught up. And again, there are some opacity and difficulty in terms of understanding books and records. Chinese companies, in our experience, have not followed the types of books, records, and internal control standards that the SEC has outlined and that the FCPA requires, particularly regarding expenses and entertainment expenses, travel expenses. So that is something to be aware of pursuing business in China. At this point, I'll turn the program over to my partner, Henry Liu.
Thank you, Bill. This is Henry Liu. My partner, Tom and Bill, have very well covered the related topics. I think my task here is someone who has a China background to try to help highlighting a few more China-specific points. Now, my three slides are all focused on China aspects, laws and practice relating to bribery and corruption in China. As was suggested by a famous case in 2008, a Rio Tinto case, which is a criminal case under the Chinese criminal law, and the Chinese laws and the practice may have important relevance to FCPA or anti-bribery rules internationally or in other countries. Here we have my first slide. It's regarding a state of Chinese anti-corruption regulatory system. Although China is a signatory to a UN Convention Against Corruption, it does not currently have a U.S. FCPA equivalent law. Chinese criminal law is the main domestic law which covers briberies, although other Chinese laws also have related provisions. With respect to bribery of domestic officials, meaning Chinese officials, Chinese criminal law makes it a crime to give bribes to state officials, state institutions, public organizations, and also state-owned enterprises, as well as for those state officials, state institutions, and state-owned enterprises to accept bribes. The Chinese criminal law also has provisions for bribery of foreign government officials and international public organizations. And the definition of bribery under Chinese law has three components. First of all, it has payment in the form of property. It can be money, can be receipts, which can be turned into money or other monetary favors. Second, the recipient must be a government official or foreign public official. And thirdly, the purpose must be to obtain improper commercial benefits, monetary benefits. As I said earlier, in addition to criminal law, other Chinese laws that contain provisions relating to bribery and corruption would include securities law, accounting law, unfair competition law, the civil servants law, and also the regulation on offer and acceptance of gifts. Specifically, and also that as we know how China is structured, there are various party rules for the from the ruling Communist Party over its over members of the party who serve as the government leaders. And the next, I want to talk about the anti-corruption regulatory bodies in China. The prosecuting agency in China is the Supreme People's Procurator, equivalent of Attorney General in the U.S. And it's very important to note that because, again, you know, how China's political system is structured, most of the or many of the bribery and the corruption cases inside China are subject to the ruling Communist Party's internal disciplinary procedures. And in China, also the Ministry of Public Security, which is the equivalent of the U.S. FBI, is the enforcement body for the criminal for criminal acts, including bribery and corruption. Currently in China, bribery and corruption carry predominantly criminal liabilities. And also, that, as I said earlier, that there are other industry-specific sanctions for bribery and corruption and related offenses. For example, the securities law would carry would have provisions about disclosures and other bribery-related or corruption-related activities in China. And also, the accounting board also have various rules against accounting professions specifically involving this type of crimes. My second slide is talking about vetting third parties and employees in China. The first issue is the third party and the government connections and affiliations. And just like in the U.S. or anywhere else in the world, third parties and third party intermediaries may pose tremendous bribery or, in the U.S. setting of FCPA-related risks in China. And although the current Chinese criminal law does not specifically provide for a third-party payment, however, there is a Supreme Court notice a few years ago in China. It has included the brokering bribery, a literal translation from Chinese, into the definition of bribery. So more specifically, it refers to unlawful payments to a third party with the prior knowledge that all or portion of a payment will be directly or indirectly be paid to a Chinese government official. It is important to, especially in China, to take a closer look at third party connections and affiliations with the government in China, because predominantly in China, although that it has undergone a tremendous of market reforms, a lot of private business have been established. However, the economy is still predominantly a state-run or state-owned economy. So it's very important for foreign companies doing business in China when you work with anybody in China, basically, either joint venture partners or consultants, distributors, or vendors, agents, you name it. That is very important to pay closer attention to who they actually are and who actually own them. Are they wholly owned by the state or the state or government at the central or local level own a piece of it, or they control it? So it's very, very important to create that distinction and also to pay very, very close attention on those kind of relationships. And not only entities, but also individuals who work for the companies in China, for foreign companies in China, or the providing services to foreign companies in China, they may also be government-related. For example, if an employee in a foreign invested company in China, that this individual can possibly probably receive benefits from state-related companies or agencies. It's very important to bear that in mind. And also that, earlier I mentioned the facilitating payment that has been prescribed in Chinese law, and also that the kickbacks and the so-called procedure payments have also been provided. So it's very important to also catch signs of red flags now, for suspicious vulnerable relationships, business connections, and the history of the parties, and the past practice, and so on. And especially that if an entity is state-owned and state-connected, that could be, you know, that's where that the problems may very well arise. And vetting employees, as I said earlier, that you know, for foreign companies operating and investing in China, preventing employee risks, especially in areas of corruption and bribery, is very, very important and also a challenging task. First of all, considerable care and attention should be placed in hiring and supervising employees, especially the locally hired employees who may not be familiar with the U.S. Corporate culture or legal customs. This may include, you need to conduct background check, especially for the prospective, even current employees, and for their current government connections. They're also very important to establish, proper delegation of authorities, especially for those employees who have, more frequent interactions with the government. For example, the sales person dealing with the government contracts in China. It's worth special special attention. Secondly, that the work does not only stop at the hiring. Ongoing training, systematic counseling, regular auditing, and constant reviewing, like what Bill was saying, that in China even, it also can be helpful in terms of creating some mitigating effects when there are investigations, not only from the U.S. aspect, but also that, even from the China aspect. And so, policies, and ethical policies, compliance culture are also very, very important. And my third slide is a few quick takeaway points. To summarize what I said earlier, is it's very important to pay special attention to third-party intermediaries and their direct and indirect government affiliations, and for employees that their background, their training, their and also that ongoing supervisions. And also, it is very important to pay attention not only for the FCPA or foreign or U.S. in this instance U.S. laws, but also the Chinese anti-corruption rules, because as we have seen from the past cases that they do affect companies operating in China from the domestic Chinese legal point of view. And the last point is crisis management and effective dealing with Chinese regulators in government investigations and the proceedings. In many cases, even for the FCPA type of investigations in China, you have to deal with not only with the private party, but also invariably and frequently, you have to deal with various regulatory bodies in China. So I think that's all of our slide presentations. Thanks so much for listening. And we'll now hand over to Joe for the next session, which is Q&A. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much, Henry. And thanks to the three of you. It was a fantastic presentation here. Again, that was Tom Shoesmith, partner and leader for Pillsbury's China practice, Bill Sullivan, partner and co-leader for Pillsbury's corporate investigations and white-collar defense practice, and Henry Liu, partner and leader for Pillsbury's financial institutions and infrastructure teams for Asia and Greater China. Quick note here, if you'd like a copy of the slides just presented, you can get those from the drop-down menu on the bottom left-hand side of your screen. I want to move to our question and answer session. My first question, I wanted to direct at Bill, if you could. You talked a little bit about the enforcement environment in China. We've done a number of stories on new regulations in China and new rules that come up, but they almost always, towards the end, have a legal expert saying that it's not yet clear whether the rule will be enforced uniformly or even at all. Now, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the enforcement environment in China and whether that's changing in any way. Are they starting to put some teeth into the regulations they create and starting to enforce them maybe more uniformly, or maybe they're not?
Sure. There's been a relatively inconsistent enforcement or application of local regulatory laws in China that my clients have experienced. Obviously, we do our very best to comply with local law. We have a good eye in terms of what local law requires. Sometimes we engage local counsel to make sure that we understand and comply with local law. One of the bigger problems has been to understand whether or not a particular regulatory or enforcement inquiry or action is legitimate or not, whether it's being driven because of a good faith, well-based concern about a potential impropriety or infraction that may have been committed by the U.S. company, or whether or not it's motivated by personal interests on the part of the inspectors who may be acting ultra vires or on their own. And I know a number of my clients, I think this might dovetail with a question that was actually asked about legalized shakedowns, I think the questioner suggested. One of the situations is many times companies are approached by outside regulators and there doesn't seem to be a legitimate or fundamentally sound basis for an inquiry or an enforcement action. And it's very important for the company to understand whether or not there is a legitimate basis and to track its actions and to be able to mount a defense. But I would say most importantly, be ready to have outside counsel, either local or U.S., depending on the nature of the company, the nature of the business, because in our experience, that has muted and significantly reduced jeopardy in connection with these types of inquiries. Many times counsel can start to focus on whether this is motivated by the government agency or regulatory body itself, or as I said before, you've got a couple of one-off actors seeking to line their own pockets. And as soon as outside counsel, be it local or U.S., gets involved and sends that message that we're taking this very seriously and we'll track the facts and we'll deal with the regulatory body and perhaps your supervisor, we found that these matters are resolved pretty promptly and pretty quickly.
Well, thank you, Bill. Tom, I wanted to come to you next. We have a question here from our audience. There's been a lot going on about the audit reports on companies and units based in China and a bit of a clash between the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board, that's the PCAOB, and the Big Four and the auditing regulators in China. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about where that stands and why it might matter to any company that's doing some business there.
Sure. This issue got a lot of press at the end of last year because there was a sort of an accounting cliff looming, and there was some concern that if certain deadlines passed, any company that was in a position where it had to have a PCAOB qualified accounting firm in China do its audit report, and that applies to companies who have a substantial amount, percentage of their businesses in China. If you have a little bit of business, then it's not a problem because your U.S. accountants or international accountants can handle the whole thing for you. But if you need to rely on a Chinese accounting firm, if the PCAOB were to pull the qualifications, the registration for that accounting firm, then you would no longer have a PCAOB qualified accounting firm doing the audit, and that's a problem for your SEC filings. The problem that the PCAOB was facing was their internal policies require them to do an audit, sort of a compliance audit on international PCAOB registered firms by a certain deadline. That deadline came and went once already. It's now come and gone again, and the PCAOB has, despite rattling its swords, hasn't actually done anything. If it's going to do anything, it would institute a separate proceeding to de-qualify or deregister a Chinese PCAOB qualified firm. So although it's worrisome, it's moving at the speed of a glacier, and I think companies should keep their eye on it but not worry about it too much. The other thing that's happening is the SEC is requesting documents from auditors of some particularly China-based companies. That may not apply to people on this call. And the Chinese auditors are refusing to supply the documents. The Deloitte case is the most famous one. That came out of the Longtop financial audit. The Chinese auditors are saying it would violate Chinese state secrecy laws for them to transmit work papers out of China. And they've even gone and asked the state, the Chinese authorities, if that would be the case, and what a surprise. If you ask the Chinese authorities if you can send a bunch of stuff out of China, they said no. That's a surprise.
Right.
A lawsuit has ensued in the U.S., and pressure is being put on Deloitte. The risk, of course, is that if Deloitte, caught in between a rock and a hard place, decides not to turn over documents despite a court order, the SEC will bar Deloitte China from practicing before the SEC, and that would be a big problem for Deloitte clients.
I see.
But again, that's not moving real fast either.
Well, thank you. Henry, I wanted to come to you next. You talked a little bit about third-party consultants. What are some of the things to watch out for in engaging third-party consultants in China? And kind of a second part of this question, how do I ascertain if a business partner has a direct or indirect government affiliation in China?
Okay, good. Thank you, Joe. Some of my co-presenters mentioned earlier, that in China, that guanxi or relationship is very important in business transactions. And that although that's a local cultural customer issue, however, it does reflect on how to properly abide all the laws either in China and also in the U.S. So as I said earlier, that it's very important when engaging a third-party consultants in China. Many of them would claim they have relationships, and that it's very important to watch out for a few points. First of all, is their government affiliations. Later on, I'll cover the second half of the question with how to identify either if some entity or individual have government direct or indirect government relations. Second is their prior compliance records. There have increasingly improved situation where that certain information can be obtained in China for both corporate and also individual records. Also that I would say that trying to obtain certificate or warranties from third parties acknowledging that they will be, whatever they do, they're going to be complying with the anti-corruption rules. Also that try to watch out for unusual payment patterns or financial arrangements. For example, if someone demands only cash payment, if someone demands direct payment to be paid to an unfamiliar account, and it's very important to treat that as red flags. And also that by working with certain parties, if you have already established a working relationship with them, watch out for their corporate behavior, their transparency in dealing with the business records, and so on. And also that even simply like, if a company or individual has been recommended by government or by government officials, for those of you who have experience doing business in China, often at the middle of the dinner, you see that the government official popped up coming here to toast you. Then, watch out if they have mentioned a particular, recommended a particular parties to work with you or consult you. And it's not like that all these parties are, you cannot work with them. However, you probably need to pay special attention to the government connections. And Joe was asking that how to identify a direct or indirect government relations. I think for example, on a corporate level, it's very important to look into who the owners, immediate, visible, or obvious owners, and also that ultimate owners of the party that you're dealing with. In many cases nowadays, that they may appear like a listed company, they may appear like a private company. However, there might be state-owned interests in it. So, as I said, some Chinese corporate record sources, such like equivalent of the U.S. like state registrar, you can dig into, and you can easily engage any lawyers or credible or certified professionals to help you to find that. And so it's very important to go through that route. And also for individuals, it's also important to find out if they in fact have any existing or current government connection. For example, that there are individuals in China, although that they're still on the government payroll. They may be on a leave of absence or extended leave of absence, or in many cases, they would come to a foreign investor company to apply for jobs. So it's very important to look into, among other things, one thing is like personal file. In China, every adult, every work working individual would have a working file. That file goes with him or her to any company or any entity that he or she works with. And if it's if someone comes to apply for a job with a foreign company, and his or her working file has to be with one of the certified agencies that can keep such records and can refer such individuals to work with foreign individuals. So it's very important to notice all these nitty-gritty things that try to avoid complicated things that you don't want to have there.
I see. Well, I think we have time for one last question here. Bill, I wanted to stay on the topic of third parties. I know it's a real trouble spot for our audience and something they're really concerned about. Now, we have a very good question from our audience here on this idea that many third parties in China provide relationship assistance rather than, you know, real technical assistance in acquiring businesses. In paying commissions, what type of support do you suppose be received? For example, detailed receipts of work performed, et cetera. And my question is, you know, if I'm hiring someone who provides relationship assistance, is that a real trouble spot, and what should I be looking out for there?
Sure, it is a good question. It's something we deal with all the time. We're actually in the middle of putting in a supplemental compliance program for a major U.S. retailer, and this precise question has been raised, and we've been addressing it. Let me begin. I know we don't have a lot of time, but let me begin by saying that, again, I take the perspective.
I'll ask you to keep your answer brief here if we can.
All right. You're allowed to do your business. I don't want companies and clients paralyzed and afraid of the FCPA. There is a place for relationship work. A realtor, for example, gets a relationship going. What you need to do is understand what the real value component is. Make sure the commission is reasonable. Make sure there's no opportunity for this third-party relationship person to be funneling money to the potential customer as a pass-through. What we do is we require very detailed proofs of service, and we have a very detailed questionnaire that goes out to this relationship person at the very beginning, so we have our eyes open and we don't miss red flags.
You know, another just kind of follow-on question from our audience is, and I think it's one we can address very quickly, are there any particular industries that, you know, the Justice Department is looking at in regard to China for FCPA enforcement? Are there some that are under more scrutiny than others right now?
Because of the rapid deployment of Western businesses in China as an emerging market, the topic that I talked about before, they're very interested in M&A transactions to the extent that there isn't due diligence and successor liability can be pursued. There are a couple of high-profile cases out there right now concerning that. That is a real focus area for DOJ. The acquisitions by Western companies and the joint venture efforts by Western companies to pursue Chinese business opportunities without potentially having both eyes open.
Well, thank you, Bill. And I want to thank all three of you again. Just a fantastic session here. I think we've learned a lot about doing business in China and what some of those compliance and regulatory risks are. Again, everyone, our guests were Tom Shoesmith, partner and leader for Pillsbury's China practice, Bill Sullivan, partner and co-leader for Pillsbury's corporate investigations and white-collar defense practice, and Henry Liu, partner and leader for Pillsbury's financial institutions and infrastructure teams for Asia and Greater China. And a special thanks to Pillsbury Law for making this webcast possible. The webcast has been recorded, should be available sometime in the next few hours online. CPE credit is now available for those archive webcasts, and you can find those on our on-demand CPE library under the webcasts tab at www.compliancework.com. Once again, to obtain your CPE credit, after the presentation, wait until I finish this wrap-up, and at that point, the webcast will close automatically and the final exam will be presented in a separate window. For any reason you have trouble viewing the CPE test or receiving the CPE certificate, send an email to info@compliancework.com. and we'll get that cleared up. This concludes our webcast. I want to thank our presenters once again, and I want to thank all of you for joining us, and have a great afternoon. Goodbye.